So this is an interview with Dr. Roswell Botwell. The date is June 17th, 2013. We are sitting in a conference room at the top of McArdle Library. So Dr. Botwell, during our last interview, we talked a bit about your research collaborators. I'd like to dig into that question a little more. So which colleagues were instrumental to your work?
Well, many colleagues contributed to my approach to research. You have to go back to my parents, where they said, don't argue, discuss. That was the final bottom line of lots of detailed parenting. And I certainly learned the importance of that as I was a grad student over in biochem with Hart and Elvium as major professors. They had an agreement, I think, so that they cooperated on certain items of research, but Professor Hart was really my major professor, and his last year was the year I got my PhD, so he had time to come into the laboratory, sit down and stroke his chin a little and philosophize. And that would be, to me, and at that time, Bob Geyer. Biochem had practiced, or at least some of the professors, Elvim and Hart did, of pairing up a new graduate student with an established graduate student that had already maybe had its PhD or was about to. And I had that good experience with Ed Shantz. And he went on to do very important work with and also Bob Geyer, who I worked with as a beginning graduate student, went on to Harvard Medical School and the Department of Public Health, and was a very productive man there. We had, I had very good co-workers, very good instructors. For example, even though Elvim had very little to do with my research, I could go in and sit down with him and show him a table of data, and he'd say, gee, don't you think it would be better if you presented that table, the data, in a little different form? Little things like that I'd pick up from him in just an hour or two or less a week, whereas Hart would come in first thing in the morning, all of us would be up in our animal room, up in the animal rooms taking care of our animals for the day, and you'd have a chance to interact with your professor and learn thereby. And all of those things before I came to McArdle certainly had a big impact.
Mm-hmm. So
Carl Baumann was one of the professors over in biochem who was a major professor for Jim and Betty Miller. And Carl had some respect for me and asked me to do some summaries for a journal he had started with several other professors around the country to give short discussions of important papers, milestone papers in research. And so he gave me good leadership in how to write a manuscript that got a lot of information over in few words, and that journal wasn't for prior publication of research, but to go to maybe schools of home ec as well as undergraduate biochemistry departments to get general views, summarized views of many aspects of nutrition and biochemistry. So those were the professors that shaped me and prepared me for McArdle. As you know, Bauman and Rush had had a close relationship early in the cancer research on this campus before Bauman went over to become a professor in biochemistry.
So, can I ask you about some of your colleagues at McArdle? So, what was your relationship with Jim Miller, and what was it like to work with him?
Because Jim Miller and I had eaten lunch together every noon over in biochem, where we brought our cases of tomato soup and vegetable soup by the case that we'd buy at a grocery store and bring in, and mix that with a little of my milk. We certainly knew Jim Miller for a long time, and Jim knew his biochemistry backwards and forwards. I learned a lot from him, and when I had an idea, I'd go and discuss it with him and ask him what he thought. And there is the idiom that two heads are better than one, and certainly that was true when I had to present, or when I decided to present an idea to Jim or ask a question about something. I could phrase it better, and if I knew I was going to talk to Jim first, then we'd have a good discussion.
Mm-hmm. Are there any particular ideas that you can, that kind of sprang out to you that really was sharpened by your discussions with Jim Miller?
One of the important ones was how something that isn't carcinogenic, no matter what you do, can react with a small amount of carcinogen and get a lot of tumors in an animal.
Mm-hmm.
And that discussion, when he said, it's a problem that no one knows an answer to, I can't answer your question, I decided to really go to work on that. And that work culminated after several years in a manuscript that was cited more times than any other journal article, any other specific article in that specific journal.
Mm-hmm. What was the title of the article?
It had to do with the factors, the biochemistry, the biology, now I'm getting it, the biology of how cancer develops and what all goes into it. What are the steps? What are the stages? Is it just a single continuum, or can it be divided into one or more, into two or more individual biochemical steps, and that biological steps? And that turned out to be the case, and that was the basis then of the biochemistry of the various steps, the two steps of carcinogenesis.
Mm-hmm. So how about your relationship with Betty Miller? What was it like to work with her?
Well, Betty Miller, you could go to Betty and ask any question, and she knew the answer. And to have someone that can give you good advice on a manuscript, on a particular problem you're facing in presenting data, she knew how to do it. She was a very good, true scientist. She was an assistant director to Dr. Pito and became director of the department, and certainly she did a good job.
Mm-hmm. Also, I'm interested in your remembrances of Van Potter as well. Did you
work
with
Potter? Is an idea man. I've known two excellent idea men in my experience here at McArdle, and one is Potter and the other is Jerry Mueller. Potter had a fellowship from, he got his PhD in biochemistry on this campus with LVM, and had a PhD, had a postdoctoral fellowship over in England and in the Scandinavian countries in the years just before World War II. And when the things looked bad, they decided he'd better come back to this country, and that's when he began at McArdle. While in Europe, Potter had adjusted or adapted, I guess you'd say, a custom, and that is the leader of a research group would have a break for afternoon tea. And so when Potter came over here to McArdle, he attracted a postdoctoral and had a little money to do so when the rest of us weren't that well established and couldn't attract outsiders, and that is potential graduate students or postdoctorals, simply because the subject wasn't that well developed, whereas Potter was doing enzymology. So they go over to the old hospital, and there was a dining room there, and it was a very small capacity place. The doctors had one room and the rest of the staff another, and they were just what might have been patient rooms. They were small. We went over and occupied the doctor's rooms because it was a doctor's room, because it was during work hours and it was available, and it'd be like a little seminar, and we'd talk about our research and so on. But his research and his focus was enzymes, and so after 6 months or a year, I had my work sufficiently well established so that while I consulted with Van frequently, I did not go to those little teas that they had in the afternoon. We had a little different procedure for contact, and that was based on the program that Professor Hart, he was a professor, not a doctor, because he was caught up in earlier, he was caught up because his wife got ill and had to come back from Germany, where all the PhDs were given in those days, because his wife was ill, and she died relatively young, so he was a bachelor for quite a while. Well, they would, Professor Hart would come up into the animal room every morning and have contact with his students, and that's when we'd really interchange ideas. But because it was in his last years, he would come into the lab quite a bit because he wasn't really that busy, and really give us good philosophy, good advice. The words of an older man certainly helped Bob Geyer and myself, who were his two students at that time.
Mm-hmm. Can I return really quickly to another question about Betty Miller? Do you think she was discriminated against because she was a woman? I know she was the only woman in the lab.
Betty was an unusual woman in many ways. Let me start by telling you a little bit different about McArdle. Dr. Rush was a penny pincher, right. He kept our salaries low because he thought that by keeping budget program asking for research money, for grant money, that the grants would be more acceptable if they weren't too big. And so we kept our salaries strong, relatively low, except maybe for Jerry Mueller and Potter. Jerry, because he was a PhD and went MD, as well as PhD and P2O also. But with respect to Betty Miller, it was really not good. She was really kept on a low salary. And his rationale, and he'd tell it to me, that the two of them together got all the money they needed to live on and then some. He was an example of it. In staff meeting, he'd say, gee, now don't take pencils home unless they're too short to go in the pencil sharpener. Things like that, really. But he wasn't really that kind of a man for anything else. He was a broad idea man also. In fact, he had friends in the ag school and so on. He was such a friendly person. And they'd say, I've got an idea here that some strawberries that I've been working on to get this good breed of strawberries is also going to help prevent cancer. Well, probably nowadays, maybe we do admit that there's something in fruit that is good against cancer. But in the crude assays that we had, it didn't show up. And Dr. Rush would always bring that to me to do. And there were several examples of that where he'd bring things like that to me.
Hmm.
So with respect to Betty Miller, she would get up at cancer meetings when people, the American Association for Cancer national meetings with 100 people or more, 200 people in a big meeting room. Maybe I'm underestimating the number of people greatly. And she'd get up and make a speech that there is no discretions against women. They stand on their own feet. I've always believed that I wasn't discriminated against, and yet she was discriminated woefully with respect to salary.
Is this something that
isn't that all true, Betty? Aren't you aware of that? Yeah.
Is her low salary, is it something you and your fellow other researchers at McArdle would discuss? Did you think it was
no,
fair?
We didn't discuss politics. We didn't discuss it wasn't like some departments where there's a lot of politics or a lot of problems. It wasn't that original group of Rush, Potter, the Millers, myself, and then Jerry Mueller was a close-knit group. It was the department first. There was just nothing. All the doors were open always, and that philosophy I think probably exists still today to a fairly good extent, although I think it has changed a little, partly because of size, partly because they have joint professorships whose loyalties are split, and maybe the loyalty to the department isn't necessarily as great now as it once was.
So can I ask you now about Jerry Mueller? Like, what was it like to work with him?
Jerry and I became good friends, and like Rush and Potter, he was an idea man. He really had ideas. He was my roommate at national cancer meetings. Wherever we'd travel, we'd be roommates. We'd talk in the evening after everything was over till midnight, and then go out and get a hot pastrami sandwich or something like that. Always talking science, always talking ideas. And he had so many that he listened to mine once in a while too. And actually, if you look at his bibliography, he even did published papers where he got ideas that arose from our work, where he worked with the processes, biochemistry processes involved in carcinogenesis.
Hmm. So also the last person to sort of ask about, so how about Charles Heidelberger? What was it like
well,
to work with him?
Charles Heidelberger came in and he brought in a technique, the use of isotopes. Dr. Rush had heard about Heidelberger, and he was in Chicago at the time, and I don't recall if it was a short time or if he was there for 6 months or a year or something, I don't recall. But he made an appointment, and several of us, Rush, Potter, myself, maybe Jerry and Jim, I don't think Jerry, maybe went down because to Chicago to hear him and meet him and then invite him up to Madison, and he came. He did a lot of, he was a joint writer of manuscripts, designer of experiments with Potter and maybe with other people in the department. I don't have to remember right now. But he led to some things that impacted me. But there was a coincidence that wasn't reversed, and that was that Dr. Rush had picked me to be the person in McArdle to be familiar with radioactive isotopes and their use in biochemistry. And it happened that a school was just started down at Oak Ridge for that purpose, and Dr. Rush arranged for me to go down to attend that school for 2 weeks or a month, I've forgotten. And that coincided with Heidelberger, and it was set up just before Dr. Rush heard about Dr. Heidelberger, and then he made the commitment for him to come up. But in the meantime, he had me go down there and learn about it too. And so I don't recall of any joint experiment that Charlie and I did, because I had the knowledge of the isotopes, but he did do cooperative research and had a big impact on this department, because there was just no one else in carcinogen cancer research was using isotopes really at that time, as I recall. So he did have a big impact on the department. But I suppose I, this is a story I shouldn't tell. I had an excellent graduate student, and working for an MS. And Charlie was on his committee for his MS degree. Charlie had an overbearing personality sometimes when it came to research, and it would show up even at national meetings sometimes. And it certainly showed up against this poor student. He was an excellent student. He was working with one of my excellent graduate students working for a PhD, and he just slashed him to pieces during his MS oral exam, and he quit and became a student in the medical school for an MD as a result.
So what was your response to that?
Well, there wasn't much response to me.
I see.
Because the student made up his mind, there was nothing that I could do. In fact, I think I brought his thesis. No, this is Helen Baldwin's thesis. That was another prize student that never finished, but that was for a good reason why she didn't finish.
Why was that?
Well, She had a good project that was really a project that was a little out of my area of past experience, but it was something that I recognized was relevant because we'd come into recognizing and supporting what others had shown, particularly in England, the difference between an effect of a compound on DNA when it was possible, when it was a reactive compound and would react with an animal's DNA without doing anything, in contrast to what the Miller's type of research was with the type of compound that needed modification by the body to make it into a reactive form that would react with DNA and cause a mutation. And that it was in that area that Helen Baldwin was working. She gave one of the nicest papers, and if I haven't got something straight and messed up here, no, this is Helen Baldwin. Helen Hochgraf was her name. She gave one of the best presentations, oral presentation at a national cancer meeting. It attracted a big crowd because of the subject matter, and one of the best presentations you ever heard, and that was on the subject of the matter that was her master's degree. It ended up, it was never published because Helen fell in love with a young professor that she met, probably assistant professor, new in the law school, and I never saw a person, male or female, go so overboard. Changed her attitude, just a tremendous change. He fell in love like no one I've ever seen before. And they eventually became married. She stopped being a graduate student because of that. Her thesis ended up not being published, but she did write a thank you in the dedication, if I can see it. Without the encouragement, guidance, and faith of me, this thesis and its project, the project it summarized would never have been completed. And she also was working with Horanzi, a person from Poland who was a postdoctoral with me, who came over because he was working on carcinogens and their in industry. There was large incidence of clinical cancer. And Horanzi was in a medical school and very much aware of that problem and came over here to learn about that. Well, she also gave Horanzi, who was an active partner in the early phases of her work and a source of continuing aid, merit, and more than gratitude. And Horanzi was also a very outstanding postdoc that came in my group for a while, and we had contact with him right up to the last few years. Excellent man.
Hmm. Yeah, and Helen Baldwin went on to be the assistant director of the Comprehensive Cancer Center here, right?
At one time, Dr. Rush had to make a decision, maybe Betty knows something about this, between quick Betty,
pause.
had to make a decision between keeping Ilsa Regal and Helen Baldwin. And later he came with me to me and said I made the wrong decision. But Dr. Rush did take Helen Baldwin over to clinical cancer, clinical oncology, when he became head of that department. And Helen Baldwin went on to make a name for herself among the national permanent employees at the National Cancer Institute. She carried good messages about the University of Wisconsin and helped all of us, I'm sure, by the good work that she could do nationally as a representative of the human oncology group that Dr. Rush headed up, and helped us also at McArdle, even though I'm sure we stood on our own feet and didn't have many problems in getting our grants, individual grants, and our program project grants funded. Of course, competition wasn't as serious as it is today, but it was serious.
Mm-hmm. So I think it's really interesting that many of the key McArdle scientists were trained at UW-Madison. So you, Jim Miller, Van Potter, Harold Rush, Jerry Mueller, I think Betty Miller as well.
That's right.
So do you think that the fact that so many of the McArdle scientists were trained here shaped the culture of the laboratory?
I think that was important because Dr. Rush also had insight into the personalities of the people that were involved, and that was a strong, it was a great strength of McArdle in that we did have good personalities and we worked well together. None of us thought about ourselves or our salaries or anything else. There was always open doors, and there still are, I think. Just a good feeling.
So you talked a little bit in our interviews previously about the weekly seminars held at McArdle. So when did they start, and who started them?
I would say that the Millers were a good, strong force for it, but they started right from the start when there'd be just a small room like this where the secretary's office was in the old McArdle building, and that was where we'd meet, and there'd just be Rush, Potter, Jim Miller, and me at first. And we'd meet weekly, and then Potter did get a postdoc fairly soon, and so the fields that were covered were expanded, and Betty Miller came, and she had a strong influence to keep those journal club small group meetings. There weren't any grad students with the Millers or with me or any of us then, and we just started meeting every week and talking science and some very important things that impacted all of our research resulted from those meetings.
Mm-hmm. So you would present research, you would talk about journals. What other things would you do in these meetings?
Well, I would say that our own research often took a second place at that stage, and it was more what we learned from others. But our own research was critiqued to some extent, but as the department enlarged, certainly it split really into two things. The faculty itself would meet every week and talk research and business when it was needed. And in the first years, business was hardly ever needed. It just automatically took care of itself.
Mm-hmm. So when these got to be bigger meetings, was it stressful to present your work, or did you expect sharp critiques from the colleagues?
I think presenting the work to people on the staff wasn't particularly stressful, but you also knew that if it stood the discussions that came up and the questions that were asked and flaws weren't discovered in a presentation of one's research program, that it would fly nationally, that it would probably be accepted for publication by the most critical reviewers, that it would likely get funded. It helped a lot to have that discussion of one's research among a closely knitted group that only had one goal, and that was to just make everybody's research better.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to talk a little bit more about Harold Rush, if we can. So how was he, what was he like as an administrator?
Well, he was probably in some ways a hands-off administrator. He had been in cancer research very early, as that, for example, the American Association for the Advancement of Cancer, whatever the proper name is. He was involved in that early, and that helped a lot with respect to feedback to the rest of us. But he was a gentle director, and while he was co-author with me of most of my papers, maybe even after I got to be an assistant professor, one didn't think anything of it, and actually he had really very little to do about it. He didn't make any suggestions, really. But he was very supportive, and you couldn't ask for a better man for your boss or your director, your major professor, for the head of a department than Dr. Rush. As long as you did your job, there were one or two people that were here. One, Dr. Rush thought that immunology should be an important approach to cancer research, and he got a new PhD out of one of the Chicago schools, universities, with good recommendations, and was here for just a short time, maybe 3 years, I don't recall precisely. And not encouraged to stay longer. So he was a good judge of good science, and when necessary, he could make a decision like that. But he had a very kindly and helpful manner towards the staff.
Mm-hmm. Would you go to him with scientific questions or mostly administrative help that you needed from him?
Well, there really were no administrative questions, because we just sort of rolled on, and we didn't have any problems with administrative questions. Really, we weren't concerned about. Really, at least I wasn't. I didn't think about becoming an assistant professor from an instructor, whatever I was hired as, or any other promotion or salary. And I think most of the rest of us were. Maybe Charlie Heidelberger might have been a little different, but I don't think Jim or Betty or anybody really was concerned about those sorts of things, and I don't think felt the need to go to Dr. Rush on such things. He was just a very good hands-off administrator and let each of us do our thing. And as I say, even though up until maybe two or three papers after I became an assistant professor, his name was on it, on our manuscripts together. And probably about that time, he may have gotten a little bit more of a research program of his own going also.
Mm-hmm.
I don't just recall the chronology of it.
So did the atmosphere at McArdle change when Rush left to establish the Comprehensive Cancer Center in 1972?
Well, let's see, in 1972, is that when Pito became elected? We elected our own chairman, which was the policy in general of the university,
mm-hmm.
and he received unanimous approval for director until he got a request to help with the deanship and other things. So that transition went very smoothly, and at least I didn't notice the difference between Rush and Pito. I don't ever recall just sitting down and talking to Pito in his office about anything about salary or administrative question of any sort. Of as long as we got our grants, why we if we'd accomplished enough, we could ask for enough money in our grant to take care of technicians and graduate students or postdocs as we progressed along in our own research abilities.
So Pito, in a lot of ways, carried forward Rush's sort of style?
I would say so. I'd say he carried it exactly.
So were there any differences that you noticed?
I didn't notice any differences that I'm aware of. We had our weekly meetings just the same. I don't recall any differences.
Mm-hmm. So I know that
I don't think I'm unique. We didn't concern ourselves with administration.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that the Millers, even though Betty was the assistant administrator, and she probably did take care of the details that perhaps Pito brushed over and the rest of us might have too.
Mm-hmm. So that was, for the most part, her role as the associate director?
Beg your pardon?
That was her role as the associate director, was to take care of details primarily?
Well, I think she probably just did that naturally. She certainly, the research of the Millers was of the highest quality. I wouldn't be surprised if they had gotten a Nobel Prize. The P450, which they discovered with respect to the metabolism of a compound that isn't a carcinogen per se, like the dimethyl, like the carcinogen the Millers used to cause liver cancer. It had to be metabolized by the body. Well, the same thing that metabolized that carcinogen to the active form also metabolizes drugs, metabolizes much of our food that is handled through the liver and other organs. It's just a basic discovery that they made and exploited through the years.
Mm-hmm. So I'd like to shift a little bit to talk about the kind of the facilities here at McArdle. So when you first arrived as an assistant professor at McArdle, what was your lab like? What was it like to work here? What was your laboratory like when you first arrived?
When I first arrived here, well, let's have a little more history of McArdle itself.
Yeah.
McArdle gave the money, which because of various things, you'll get the reasons from somebody else, expanded to a lot of money and built a four-story building that was attached to the old university hospital. And it was a four-story building with a basement in addition. Because McArdle was small, Dr. Rush, we were a small group. We were located on the two top floors, and X-ray department, which was shorter in space, had the basement first and second floor for their operations in X-ray.
So where was your lab space?
And my lab was one room to begin with, and with working alone on the fourth floor, and the animal rooms were on that floor, and my animal rooms were there. The Miller's animal rooms were four on that floor. A name we haven't mentioned, LePage, had a few animals, but he was allergic to them, and I had to handle his animals for him, as I recall. And that fellow that came from Chicago to do immunology was put on the fourth floor, and that pretty much filled it up. There was not much more room. On the second floor, it was Potter with his group and the Millers with their group. I don't recall right off where Charlie went. Where he went and where we went to have our radioactive measurements analyzed. It was a lab of technicians that did that for the whole department, and Heidelberger was responsible for that laboratory. And I'm not just sure where it fit in physically, but we became crowded in that. And when it became really crowded, because that building had been dedicated for cancer research, it was perfectly legitimate for Dr. Rush to ask to get X-ray out. There was construction also going on at that time with the basic university hospital, and there was a little bit more room for X-ray to move into, so it all worked out okay. And so Heidelberger, Temminar, Nobel Prize winner, went into that basement room just a year or two before, just a short time before we moved over here. He was really cramped. It was amazing that he was willing to accept an offer to come here because of such poor physical conditions he had to work in.
Did you have enough space? Did you have everything you needed?
When the department got the whole building, as I described a minute ago, then I had room to expand. And it was about that time that enough interest had been developed nationally and internationally, so it was actually almost internationally first. I got a postdoc from England because I was one of the few people in the United States doing that sort of work on the biology of tumor formic carcinogenesis. He was doing that sort of work over in England, and so he came over here as a postdoc with his family, a young child, just a babe in arms, when he came. But it was at a time when we were just expanding, and so we had adequate space.
Mm-hmm. So when did you begin to mentor students, both graduate students and postdocs? And about how many, when did you begin to mentor students, and what was it like to first take on that responsibility?
Well, it was a very easy matter to take on students because of space and because of the nature of the subject. There just weren't many students available. But as we started to work on the biology of the process, I began to get graduate students. They were willing to take on research in nutrition and biological effects that affected it. I came in 1945, and I had Dr. Brush, who was a co-author with Dr. Rush and me on my first paper. She had a doctor's degree in biology, but when it came to what was going on here, she was really a technician. Another reason why she was really, she hadn't had any experience in biochemistry or in cancer research. And another reason she was more of a technician, she was the wife of a graduate student. And so she was more interested in a 9-to-5 job, we'll say, than something where she put her mind to work in it as a graduate student would. So when he got his PhD and she left, and so I came in 1948. She was a co-author in that first paper where, following the lead of a Canadian who thought that caloric restriction might be a stress that might affect the adrenal cortex of an animal. And so that led to an experiment that was started soon after 1945 when I arrived, and wasn't published until 1948, namely that the adrenals of a calorie-restricted mouse showed the greater weight ratio to body weight than a mouse that had all it wanted to eat. And that weight probably represented the, not the, center of the adrenal, but that creates adrenaline, but to the cortex, which produces compounds that affect mineral metabolism and prominently by carbohydrate metabolism. So that was found to be the case. We even did an experiment where we used adrenal cortical extract on mice and gave them the carcinogenic treatment, and it protected them. It was rejected because it wasn't logical. The adrenal steroids reduced the immunological response of an animal, and therefore the cancer incidence of an animal that had more adrenal cortical activity should also be more rather than less. And so we swallowed that opinion, even though Dr. Rush was a co-author of that paper and never did publish it, but bits and pieces of of that were brought into research as years went by. And even today, I use cortisone to keep a terrible amount of skin cancer that I would have on my skin under control, rather than going to a person that deals with skin cancer and uses liquid carbon dioxide.
So if I may, just to return to the subject of graduate students, so it sounds to me that your students played a fairly crucial role in shaping the direction of the research in your lab. Is that the case?
Graduate students didn't come in till later. I was assistant professor in 1949 after I'd been here 4 years, and still Brush and Rush were on papers in 1949. In 1948, 49, 51, I was still publishing papers with Rush, and not with grad students, but with a technician or worked by myself. Graduate students just couldn't be encouraged to this. It was quite different for Dr. Potter. His work was enzymology. It was very popular, and he could get the pick of excellent graduate students and postdoctorals. The work that the Millers was doing revolved around subjects that weren't quite so closely related to the biology and biochemistry of cancer itself, but metabolism, and young potential graduate students would be interested in metabolism, and so they could attract. But of course, I am not putting myself in comparison with either the Millers or Dr. Potter. They were superior people. There is just no getting around it. I was fortunate to be in the same department with them.
So I know you were deeply involved in designing the building we're sitting in right now. So did Rush ask you to help design it, or did you volunteer to do it?
Rush didn't believe in committees. He because everything went so smoothly in this department, we didn't have any committees. It just worked well because we all had the right attitude, the right cooperative attitude. So there just weren't any committees, and he just didn't believe in having a lot of people work on things. He thought that one person could make better decisions easier. He had, it was amazing that I could do as much research as I did all through those first years, because early on he made me the representative of the department with outside departments and with the building department, with the plumbers and the electricians and so on across the street that took care of problems around the building. He just recognized that I could work with people very easily. He also recognized that I could solve problems that came up, and that I had a very practical nature as well as a theoretical researcher. And so he appointed me to that and job. And in 1960, that was very close, this can be properly verified, very close to when Helen Baldwin got married and was working with Dr. Rush here, and he put her in as my assistant and took care of the details. Well, she was just excellent, and we had, as you've heard before, excellent rapport. So we made a good team. I had read a little bit about the construction of laboratories, and so all of the ideas here weren't entirely original, but the building was built specifically for research. It turned out to be the cheapest per square foot of a tremendous amount of building that was going on for the chemistry department on this campus, for some of the departments in the ag school, and we got more laboratory space in those than those laboratories did. We got more laboratory space per dollar than anybody. It was inexpensive to build. It was very efficient for use. I think the department members were very appreciative of the building that we got. It was designed uniquely and quite different from most departments. Offices were on the top floor. The bottom floor was supportive services and the lecture room. And in between were researches. The top floor was administration. The eighth and ninth floor were animal rooms. The philosophy behind that is that all of the expensive utilities that are required in animal rooms didn't have to go throughout the whole building, but only had to go to the bottom seven floors out of a essentially 11-story building.
So were a lot of these design features you're just describing, were they ideas that you brought to the table, or were there ones that were kind of agreed on collectively?
Well, it was a little of both. The building was unique. The architects had never done a laboratory building, and that certainly helped a lot because they were willing to accept our ideas, and I think they recognized the reality of those ideas. The state of Wisconsin picked, together with the University of Wisconsin Architectural Group, Building Group, picked the architects. And the architects had only designed churches for the greater part. And they had won awards for their architectural ability. The instructions they were given was you have complete freedom to build that building as long as it isn't another pile of yellow bricks like the old medical school was. And it certainly wasn't. And it created a lot of controversy over its exterior appearance. They're precast concrete slabs that have a design in them that is supposed to de-emphasize the squareness of the building and the monotony of the placement of windows. Every unit, every 10 feet, there's a window, and that makes a terribly monotonous exterior. The architects were originally going to even use some color in this three-dimensional design that they had built into this preformed, precast concrete exterior surfaces. And I think Potter became disturbed because he had more contact around the campus, and they were disturbed about that. He was disturbed about that, and so someone came over from the another department, the art department, as I recall, and brought that exterior department precast design to what it is today, and it certainly did de-emphasize the monotony of our windows, but probably not as much as the architects originally designed.
Did you like the eventual design?
Beg your pardon?
Do you like the eventual design?
Oh, I think the exterior design is perfectly okay.
Yeah, I think it's handsome. So you describe McArdle of the sort of group here as uniquely collegial, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask if there were any sources of friction or tension in the lab at all.
I certainly wasn't aware of them. I wasn't aware of any problems as we progressed through the various ranks. I didn't know the difference when I was one or the other, what our salaries were. There wasn't any rancor within the department. Even as we added professors beyond the original group, and we'll certainly include Dr. Heidelberger with the original group. But when we go to Burgess and Dove and Drinkwater and Pito and Sugg, some of those that came, they sure worked right in with the rest of us. One professor that we brought in unfortunately died, I think, sitting in his chair at home at evening at a young age, sudden heart attack, and that was the end. He was another promising young student. And Schabowski probably was the only person that was a little bit of a misfit, but he, I think, probably published more research papers than most of us, and had more international recognition in some ways than most of the rest of us, although certainly Potter and the Millers had tremendous recognition world around. Drinkwater, some of those, he could step right in and accept the directorship of the department and elected, and it was carried on just as smoothly as it was before, even with a fairly large faculty by that time.
So one final question, sort of a summation question. What do you think made McArdle distinctive from other cancer research labs in the country?
Okay, that's sort of a hard question to answer. I hadn't really thought about that. But certainly the spirit helped. We had always had our doors open. We never worried about our salaries, and never worried about our titles. We never worried about anything. And everyone didn't worry. We all felt we were treated fairly, and it provided the unique feature of the department with respect to other departments. But certainly the Roswell Park, the center in New York City, the center down in Texas, all of my graduate students went on to be leaders of good cancer research departments in other schools, and I'm sure they brought forth the same spirit that they met with here at Wisconsin. But, well, for example, I was a visiting professor at NYU one summer, and they had a summer school at a piece of real estate that was quite beautiful, that was willed to the school that it used that place for research, and so the cancer research department had a summer use of that space, and then visiting professors were brought in. you could tell the difference right away in the spirit. It wasn't the same as it was at McArdle.
In what sense?
Well, it was, to some extent, the doors weren't open to each other. They were, everybody was working for themselves, I would say. I would say that was one of the big differences. We were all in this together, and we all helped each other together. Our weekly seminars, where we'd present our own research before the department got so great that it turned out to be the only the professors meeting weekly, and then each professor would meet with his own group to carry on a journal group type discussion. I don't think that existed at very many departments around the country. But on the other hand, I'm sure that some of mine carried through with that philosophy, and they succeeded, and many of them became department heads at all around the country. And I'm sure that they carried that feeling through as much as possible.
Great. Well, thanks so much for your time.
Almost before I got graduate students, because a few people, such as the person from Poland and the person from England, would come over because they were aware of my research, and there are such few centers that were doing that sort of research. And graduate students would come to do enzyme research or metabolism research with the Potters or Millers, whereas they wouldn't come to do nutrition and its effect on cancer. People would go to biochemistry departments to study about the newly discovered vitamins and their enzyme activities and their reasons and their discovery and all that. But to come to a very highly specialized department, it had to get established by having done a lot of establishing the biochemistry of the biology of the project first.
Mm-hmm. So when do you think you said that to attract students, your sort of work had to be established. When do you think that happened?
Well, take O'Brien, for example. It was when we had enough graduate students coming so that they would come around and visit some of the professors. And I suspect that Potter didn't have an opening, and when he came to see about my research, he said, I'm interested in doing enzyme research, is it? And I said, gee, I've been waiting for somebody. And that was when the ornithine decarboxylase, because that idea had been brewing in my own head with the effect that polyamines, the product of ornithine decarboxylase, the end product of that enzyme reaction. So he opened that field up, and that brought more people. And so it just grew.
Mm-hmm. Because he was his PhD from here in 1975,
yeah.
Tom O'Brien. Okay, so about that time, the early 70s.
I got my PhD, I guess, the year before I came here as instructor, and
yes.
I was a postdoc in biochem for a year, 1944. I think for most students in biochem, and certainly for ours, it almost was embarrassing sometimes. We let our graduate students stay along too long, but that's why when they did leave, they could get good positions, because they had published so much where they were the senior authors and obviously knew their stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Well, thanks.